and good morning. You're listening to the RBN Radio Network, the Republic Broadcasting Network, and this is Dr. Nick Begich with Changing the Way We See the World. And it's good to be with you this morning. I was up late last night trying to get back in from a trip to Dallas and almost overslept on this program. I apologize for that. It was a late night and a long day. I have a guest standing by. Are you there? Are you there? Nope, I'm not hearing that guest standing by. So
Can you hear me now, Dr. Begich?
I can indeed.
Okay, this is Eric Peterson.
Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Good morning, sir.
All right. Well, let's get into our subject matter a little bit this morning. You're going to have to remind me of the things that we wanted to cover. I am just literally waking up and getting myself organized this morning.
I know how you feel. I took a trip from Dallas last night myself out in the Southwest on a business trip. So I know how you feel, but we'll get a good conversation going.
I'm sure we will. Why don't we go ahead and start with just a light introduction? I don't have my notes in front of me, so I'm going to let you introduce yourself, and we'll pick it up from there.
Well, thank you very much. I had the honor and the privilege of reading through all of Thomas Jefferson's vast writings.
Right.
Some years ago, and I put them together in an interesting collection of essays on the American ideal, which I called Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness.
Right.
And I was very pleased that Random House picked up and published it, and it's now available in hardback and paperback. It's they call it at Random House the book that Thomas Jefferson never wrote.
Right.
So every word is his. So for if listeners looking for a good collection of Jefferson's inspirational writings with no spin, analysis, dissection, just pure Jefferson, this is what I was trying to put forth in Light and Liberty.
Right. Now, this was the this was a really exciting book for me because it was a good summation. And this is Republic Broadcasting is really known for a lot of going back to our roots, really, quite frankly, the ideas of liberty, freedom, justice, the things that Jefferson really brought to this nation and really articulated in probably one of the finest ways of any of our founding fathers. And when I was sent your review copy, I was really impressed by the editing that you had done to bring those ideas together. But from your perspective, what got you intrigued with Jefferson, or is he just one of many that you've been researching and writing about over the years?
Well, like many Americans, I think I've always had a warm, fond regard for Thomas Jefferson. He, after all, was the visionary of our nation. And when you visit his home in Monticello, you can't help but get re-inspired about our country's vision and ideals. So I took the opportunity to try to read through everything that he wrote. It's hard for people to get time to do that today. And when after working through a good 20-volume collection of his writings, I found in there great bits and expressions of wisdom that really go to the heart of what we love about our country. Thomas Jefferson's vision is the one thing that I think people around the world admire about America.
Right.
It's basically a vision of oneness and freedom. Freedom, the rights of man, self-government, particularly self-government equality, of course, and the pursuit of happiness, his famous phrase in the Declaration. It's also a vision of identification with your fellow man, what you might call oneness. A belief in
right.
the common good, faith in the average citizen,
right.
universal harmony, and ever brighter future. If you take all those concepts together, you really have the core of Thomas Jefferson's vision. And it's, I think it's the one thing that all Americans truly admire and appreciate about our country and its heritage.
Right. You know, it's almost that worldview that seemed to be, you know, I mean, people even looked at it back then. I mean, they considered they were actually creating that worldview, a change, a way to perceive government and the average person. And, you know, today, this program deals a lot, my program deals a lot with technologies, the impact of technologies, and how they've really changed democracies and democratic republics so much. In fact, every form of government has changed. But how much technologies now really determine the strength and weaknesses of countries, and within that original framework of freedom and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, responsibility and knowledge really goes hand in hand with that, especially these days where more and more you see the elites, whether it's the scientific community or the educated class, really feeling like they're in a superior position to regulate public affairs, and yet that was never the intention of our founding fathers.
Well, I think you've put your finger on one of the essential dilemmas that we have in our society today, and it's the kind of dissonance that people are concerned about in the direction of our country. When you say that there's a sense of superiority is prevailing among certain elites, I mean, that was the kind of spirit that Thomas Jefferson was particularly opposed to. If you take the essence of the idea of all men are created equal,
yeah,
what you really have there is, to me, that's the ultimate statement of humility, because it's basically a belief that no person in their deepest essence is either superior or inferior to anyone else. I mean, everyone may have different talents and virtues, and he certainly didn't mean egalitarianism in the sense that everyone has equal skills, talents, and so forth, but he did mean equality in the sense of divinely given rights, the basic essence of each individual. We're all equal, and no one should look down upon or look up to anyone else. Everyone should respect each other, and that was the essence of all men are created equal. So to the extent that you have a sense of superiority, sometimes even arrogance,
right,
sometimes even moving to the level of contempt or even to the level of hatred,
yep,
moving into public discourse and official attitudes and so forth, that kind of sense of elitism that you refer to, that's really getting away from what the founders of our country were all about.
Right, and I think, you know, what we're seeing a lot of reaction, you know, from that, you know, in the public these days, and either the form of apathy, where people just give up and quit participating, or just the opposite, hyperactivism, I call it, because it's where some of us get a little more engaged than the others and try and stimulate a little more thinking in this direction. You know, because those basic principles are the same principles, whether liberal or conservative, and I think most of our listeners would agree it's those things that we really ought to be much more concerned about than sometimes perhaps the way we individually choose to express it. But it seems like Jefferson was also a bit of a minimalist in terms of how much government we should have, and I would imagine if he saw the laws of the U.S. and their repercussions filling up a library now in every community, a law library, I think you'd be pretty surprised about that. What do you think his reaction would be to all the complexity of law as it sits today?
Well, there's a chapter in this collection of his writings called Simplicity. And Jefferson was a great advocate of simplicity, and all across the board, he said the accounts of the United States government should be made as so simple that they can be understood by a common farmer. He was very much an advocate of simplifying things down to their essence.
Well, and even the budget, as you said, there was a big fight in Congress over hiding the federal budget when they wanted to automate it. In the last last few weeks, there was a debate about making that information available, and I guess it was our senior senator from Alaska that tried to block that bill, so you couldn't go on the internet and access your budgets and find out who's getting government grants and be able to sort them randomly. You know, $1 trillion budget that we couldn't access, the budget so huge that, I mean, what was the budget back then? I mean, it had to be a few $100s that people could put together to get a meeting going. You know?
It was on the order of tens of millions, and that was it.
Yeah, and that ran the whole country.
Right. He was a great champion of honesty and simplicity, what we would call today perhaps transparency. After he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he went back to Virginia, and in the spirit of, you know, throwing off the monarchy and bringing
right.
in democracy, Republican representative self-government, he undertook to rewrite the entire code of laws of the state of Virginia, which had become encrusted by royal pronouncements and, you know, over decades and hundreds of years, a lot of British influence.
Right.
And so he boiled those laws down to maybe 200 pages, a mere 126 separate acts, to try to modernize the laws, make them more reasonable, transparent. He took the opportunity to sort of simplify and focus his visionary thinking into short, simple statements of law, particularly in the area of religious freedom.
Right.
And in other areas of education, he wrote a bill for the more general diffusion of knowledge so that people could learn more about their history, their government, their society, and so forth, and become enlightened citizens. One of his famous pronouncements is, enlighten the people generally, and tyranny and oppression of body and mind will vanish like evil spirits at the dawn of day. So he was very much for educating the people. He said the people are the only sure guardians of their liberties.
Right.
So he was a great advocate that the government be open, accessible, simple, people be involved and participate in their own self-government. Self-government to Thomas Jefferson was perhaps the primary societal virtue that he was advocating, self-government.
Well, and you know, another term you brought up, and one that's used, I know, frequently in Europe when I travel there, is this issue of transparency. It's kind of, here in this country, we've sort of accepted the idea that the public will be transparent and government will be opaque. We can't look into government anymore. It keeps getting shut down in so many ways. And all of this, you know, again, it springs from, you know, changes in the national character, certainly a sort of a view, again, a world view of government that says, hey, we have to be more cautious than ever before. We have to withhold knowledge. And really that, you know, that for many of us runs counter to what the founding fathers were about. More importantly, it really allows, again, people to withhold knowledge and gain power over larger segments of the population. And we've seen sort of this change, and I used to illustrate it where you have the leadership was at sort of the bottom of the pyramid, and it was holding the public up, and now it's the opposite. It's at the top, pressing people down. We're headed into a break. We're going to be right back after this break. You're listening to RBN Live, and this is Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. And I have on with me Eric Peterson, who wrote the book Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. And it's a reflection. It's actually all of the writing is Thomas Jefferson's. And Eric has gone through virtually all of his major writings and a lot of his, what I consider minor writings, letters and communications, and taken the best and compiled this. And this is a book that's available, I assume, on Amazon and everywhere. Is that right, Eric?
Yes, it is, and it's available both in hardback and paperback. Yep. And I wanted to allow Jefferson to have a chance to speak for himself.
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad you did this because, you know, so much, you know, people don't really, none of us really go back and start to dig out old text. It's good to see someone that has taken some of those major themes and put them into one place. It's very good reading. I really recommend that people take a look at this book. It's inspiring. It reminds us of our roots. It reminds us of the commonality that we all share, which I think is something that we often lose in our own political party's rhetoric. And I think that's something that Americans maybe are getting a little bit tired of. I think we're looking for those underlying values right now, those things that knit and weave the country together. Jefferson was one of the most incredible statesman historically. And just before the break, we were talking about this sort of bottom-up leadership, the leadership that holds you from the bottom rather than press you down from the top. And, you know, it's taken a couple hundred years to sort of flip that equation around because it always wasn't that way. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think you're focusing on another excellent point. The battle of Jefferson's time was the battle of a philosophy that the elites knew better.
Right.
You know, the common people were not really that capable of self-government. Jefferson was, of course, the leader of what was called the Democratic Republican Party at the time, opposing the elitist philosophy of the Federalists led by Alexander Hamilton. Jefferson said that one side fears most the ignorance of the people, or that they basically feared the common man. That was the Federalist Party. His side feared most the selfishness of rulers, independent of the people.
Right.
That was the difference in philosophy as he looked at it. And the things got so tense right before he was elected president in the late 1790s. The elitist party, the Federalist Party, were so into fear, and the fear of what they called mobocracy, or kind of uncontrolled actions by the ignorant mobs of the average citizen that they saw going on in France through the French Revolution, that they actually passed something I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of called the Sedition Act.
Right.
And it made it a federal crime to merely utter an opinion that was critical of the then-current Adams administration. And under the Sedition Act, 24 newspaper editors, all from Jefferson's party, were actually arrested. 14 were prosecuted, and 10 were jailed. And 10 newspaper editors, and there weren't that many more at the time,
right,
were rotting in jail 2 years later when Jefferson was elected in 1800. So it was a real serious matter at the time. And the Sedition Act was a reflection of the concern of the elite, what Jefferson called people who led by distinctions of birth and badge, the elitist, high-born,
right.
well-bred mentality, I'm superior to you in some basic fashion, that he opposed so fundamentally. That was the clash as he saw it, and he did everything he could to establish the principle that all men are created equal.
You know, and that's many folks go back to that, and talk about it, and use that in their political campaigns. But in the reality, it hasn't reflected that way in modern times. It seems like we're right back to where we were maybe at that time. I reread the Declaration of Independence recently and took a look at that Bill of Particulars, which sort of never gets read again. You know, when people quote, they always quote the, sort of the preambles and the first paragraphs. But you know, when you read the effect and actions of King George at the time, and you start to look at that in terms of where we are today, many of those same complaints are being raised again. It's almost a 200-year-old repeat of history, and the same tensions existing in the country, balancing security and freedom and liberty and good government. And from an elitist perspective, you know, we didn't have the multinational corporations back then driving so much of our public policy in the same way that we do now. But doesn't it seem like we're sort of back there again, sort of relearning these lessons again in the 21st century?
Very much so. Jefferson said that there are only two legitimate purposes to government: the equal rights of man and the happiness of every individual. And he was sure that the way you achieve good government was to take power and you smash it. And you fracture it into as many shards as you can, and you scatter them as widely as possible. And that's why I was a great advocate of the federal system of government that we have, with limited power at the central government level, more at the state, and most at the local. He said you place under every individual what his own eye and hand may personally superintend. Very interesting. He said that I do not agree that 14 out of 15 people are rogues. In other words, he had faith in the average citizen. But he said, I do believe that rogues would be uppermost.
Right.
In other words, self-interested people interested in greed and power and influence and control and coercion and so forth, they tend to seek the highest offices.
Yeah.
Were they successful in achieving that? You needed to have a system of fractured, scattered, checked, and balanced power to prevent their roguish tendencies from doing any real damage.
Hang in with me. We're headed to the break. We're at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Dr. Nick Begich with Changing the Way We See the World, and my guest, Eric Peterson, talking about Jefferson. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, and we're on the air with Eric Peterson talking about the works of Jefferson. Mr. Peterson is an attorney, and in New York, you're still doing that work, I assume, and doing quite a bit in this area in terms of his real interest. You know, everybody has sort of their passions, and it sounds to me, and it's obvious to me, that Jefferson and the history of the country was, in fact, your passion, and bringing that back to the public now, I think, is extremely important. Where, you know, when I look at this work, it's 34 essays that were written by Jefferson that are compiled that cover subjects like faith, happiness, aspiration, doing what is right, simplicity, living in the present, enthusiasm, patriotism, those basic underlying values. You know, it wasn't about what we individually did in terms of behaviors and choices, but was about the underlying principles, those things, those values that knit us together in a way that allowed for the maximum amount of self-expression or self-determination, I think maybe is even a better word. And that's something that we, you know, we hear a lot about, but remembering the roots of self-determination through Jefferson and through his eyes, I think, is an important and useful thing, particularly during election season. You know, when you were first getting excited about some of this material, What was the thing that jumped out the strongest in terms of Jefferson?
I think it was what you were talking about in terms of some of the things that have been lost in the evolution of our society and the way things are being looked at today. I mean, Jefferson thought that freedom had a purpose. He was obviously history's greatest champion of liberty, and to Jefferson, liberty meant freedom from coercion.
Right.
He famously said that rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. And I've sworn on the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. So he, and of course the, you know, the Declaration of Independence is a great statement of liberty. 2 years before that, he famously wrote that the God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time. The hand of force may destroy, but cannot disjoin them. So he's a great champion of liberty. And I think we all appreciate the virtues of freedom and the necessity for it. But Jefferson's philosophy, I think the founder's philosophy, was broader. They thought that freedom had a purpose. And that purpose was to allow each individual to develop themselves, to understand themselves, to listen to the truth, the light, the conscience within. He said every person has a conscience, and he called it our faithful inner monitor. He said that conscience is the only sure clue which will guide us free and clear of all doubts and inconsistencies. So he wanted to have no external coercion over individuals,
right?
So as to inhibit their inner exploration for the happiness and the truth within. And he really felt that if people were free to pursue their own inner sense of happiness by trying to develop and improve themselves and build their character and exercise their virtue, that a lot of goodness within would come out and we would tend to serve our fellow man. He really thought the purpose of freedom was to allow our inner goodness to come out. He said every human being has an interest in the peace, happiness, and prosperity of every other. And he thought that by taking away external coercion, we could deal with the ignorance within ourselves, within our society, and try to improve ourselves and enlighten our society to get to that greater sense of common happiness that we're all looking for.
You know, that, again, to kind of place this in a modern context, there was a guy, Maslow, who had this hierarchy of needs. At the very top, you know, at the bottom was the things like food, clothing, and shelter, and then safety and security, and then belongingness, being a part of something. But at the very top of that was this idea of self-actualization, being all that we were, our potentials would lead us into. And I think that, again, speaks about those roots of Jefferson, this idea that within each of us is this incredible well. In fact, in science, many of the scientists I talk to around the world, and we do a lot of work in the sciences, they always tell me, you know, it's not what we learned in the school. It was those leaps of intuition that took us really the further down the path. And when I think about that, all of us have that capability. This is something Jefferson recognized. I mean, he was a scientist as well. I mean, the guy was a very complex personality. Really, when you think about self-exploration and figuring out what you're good at, here was a guy that really engaged in everything. I mean, the sciences, the philosophy, and the debates of the day. But he always recognized this incredible potential within each person and tried to express that into our founding documents, something that when you think back historically, even in the sciences, I mean, one of the greatest inventions, the thing that took you from Dallas and me from Dallas, was an airplane, something a couple bicycle makers created in a garage when everybody in science said it was impossible. It's that same thing, I think, that Jefferson recognized in terms of the political nature of the country, that what was everyone might think is impossible can spring from this inner well that all of us possess.
Very much so. He said every man and every body of men possesses the right of self-government. I govern myself, you govern yourself, my country governs itself, and your country governs itself. It's our right, it's our duty. So he is against all forms of coercion, domination, force, interference among people and among nations. And the purpose of that, as we've been saying, was to sort of bring out that goodness within and create a broader society and out of due regard for the happiness of yourself and your fellow man. There are chapters in this book on the subject of simplicity, sincerity, self-discipline. He was very big on the importance of self-discipline in order to achieve self-improvement. There's a chapter on self-giving. That was very big on Jefferson's list of virtues, societal virtues and individual virtues. And finally, there's a chapter on self-perfection. So he really thought that in an uncoerced environment, we could deal with the ignorance that we have in this world and try to improve on it and try to enlighten ourselves and our country. And that is why I chose Light and Liberty as the title of the book, because Jefferson said light and liberty go together. No light, no liberty. And of course, by light, he meant freedom from ignorance.
Right. You know, when I think about Jefferson and I think about where we are again today, you know, the idea of coercion, you know, where this government has involved itself in conflicts literally around the world, not just the ones we're currently in. many of those start from our own interference with people's government. I think about the installation of the Shah of Iran when Iran was going through its problems, and then we really installed a tyrant. We helped him achieve his position. His people rebelled. They brought in a form of government that we really don't like. But here we are in another case in Iraq, and there's obvious very differences of a worldview held by three groups within the country, the Kurds, the Shiites, and when you start to look at these three groups in terms of their self-expression, you know, is it right to come in and try and impose our form of government or democratic republic? What would Jefferson think about this kind of imposition today?
Well, I think he'd be vigorously opposed to it. On a couple of grounds. First, basically, in terms of the right of self-government, he clearly recognized that other countries have the right to govern themselves. And so it's a violation of fundamental rights of peoples for one nation to basically conquer another. He said if there be one principle more deeply rooted in the mind of every American than any other, it is that we should have nothing to do with conquest.
Yeah.
Of course, we were on the receiving end of assertions of power at that time, 200 years ago, talking about how the world turns.
Right.
The receiving end of assertions of British power and French power. And, he called America the fragile plant of liberty, which was constantly tossed about in their wars of vanity and imperialism. He saw the day when America might rise to become a great nation. And he said, I hope our wisdom will grow with our power, and teach us that the less we use our power, the greater it shall be. In other words, a little self-restraint in the economic and military exercise of power by any great nation gains you more in the respect, admiration, esteem, and particularly cooperation of people around the world than the actual exercise of that power itself would gain you.
Right. You know, I've been involved in a number of international conferences on environment, on poverty, on technology, and one of the things that keeps coming up as a reoccurring theme is the idea that when we go into areas and start to look at how we can help, and I say that in quotes, because helping to me is, we always go in with our own perspective and assume that everyone else shares it, and that's really something that is not true. In fact, there's so many variances in government, culture, the underlying principles in terms of how people react emotionally, those things are consistent, but in terms of how we express that, in the forms of government, the forms of culture, social structures that we establish, really springs from local communities, and it's through imposition when others come in that conflicts arise and real structural problems begin to emerge. And we see that as we look around the developing world. You know, what's really happened is we've taken people that were essentially maybe economically poor from our perspective, but quite happy within their cultural context, and we have sort of reframe them into what we think is right and good. And this is really counter to the roots of American values as they were expressed by Jefferson, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. It demonstrates a kind of a disrespect for the rights of other peoples. Can you imagine someone coming over here with their values and their systems and so forth and trying to tell us and coerce us and interfere with our affairs and upset our elite equilibrium here in this country because they thought their way was better? I mean, that's the essence of the lack of humility and a sense of superiority, and it's an exercise of coercion. It violates the fundamental principles of liberty upon which this country was founded.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting as you know, time goes on, often we forget our roots, and I've suggested to listeners in the past that they grab some of these originating documents and don't just read the preambles, read the complete documents. Think about it from the context of our founding fathers and what they were trying to achieve. And real leadership, isn't loud and haughty. They don't take control. They give control. They give power. They empower people to recognize their own essence and what they're capable of. And it seems to me that, you know, 200 years ago, over 200 years ago, when these ideas were first being developed and brought into the public, that people were excited about the debate, and you saw the debate over principles and huge arguments over how to implement those principles. And eventually, of course, we had our own war over it. But when we look back, it wasn't a smooth path. You know, we had this sort of teaching in history that it was all smooth and wonderful. We had a few conflicts along the way, but everybody was on board. And that really wasn't the case. It was quite contentious back then, these ideas.
there was an extreme partisan bitterness in the late 1790s over the future direction of our country. The Revolutionary War was about two things. It was about attaining independence, but it was also the egalitarian promise of the Revolution, and the respect and the consideration of your fellow man, the common man, belief in the goodness of the common man. That belief was not widely held anywhere in the world at that time. At that time, there was the joinder of what Jefferson called kings, priests, and nobles, meaning centralized governmental power, centralized power of religious institutions, and centralized power of large moneyed interests. At that time, the feudal interests in Europe and so forth, and the emerging moneyed interests in this country. And there really was a view that the man was not capable of self-government, men were basically beasts, and they were unable to control themselves, and they were ignorant and so forth, and you really couldn't trust them with self-government. I mean, it was really Jefferson who established the principle that, yes, man is capable of living in society under laws self-imposed. At that time, of course, that was a great moment in history, and our country had evolved with enough light, you might say, the light that is necessary to go along with liberty, had been achieved in America. Jefferson was very cognizant of the fact that societies have to evolve slowly. He said the ground of liberty, and obviously the enlightenment of society that accompanies it, is to be gained by inches, is what he said. And so at that time, America was really the only model. He called it the primitive and precious model of what is to change the condition of man all over the globe. And in that 200 years, you can see the vision of Jefferson slowly spreading around the world. But he really thought the vision should spread by its own intrinsic merit and virtue of the insight and the quality of the wisdom of our founders, not by force.
Right.
And he thought that, you know, if you try to put a kind of force a country into more self-government, or more liberty than it was actually able to handle, you'd actually create a kind of a retrogression, because the evolution of society and civilization and enlightenment has to go hand in hand with the degree of liberty and self-government. So that's the other reason I think you have a real issue with some of the exercises in domination and conquest that we're involved in today. And not only is it wrong, because it violates fundamental rights of self-government, which we ourselves cherish, but it just isn't going to work. I mean, if you take some of the countries that we're looking at in the Middle East and Eurasia and Africa and so forth, they're not quite fully ready for self-government. It's unfortunately true. Everyone wishes that the whole world society was a little more evolved than it actually is. But you need to have a sense of enlightenment progress, and you need to be, particularly Jefferson believed that light meant freedom from ignorance, and he said ignorance was an excessive focus on what separates us and what divides us, on our differences, rather than on what we have in common, what unites us and what makes us all one people. In its worst form, of course, ignorance is tribalism and barbarity and cruelty. And so to the extent that people are moving along the road of enlightenment, but they're not quite there yet, it's very difficult to have any kind of form of self-government. And so if you look at a situation like Afghanistan or like Iraq, you know, you can say, well, that they haven't quite enough light for their liberty. It's no knock on any people. It's just an observation of the evolutions of societies. And so are they really capable of handling self-government, or the need to move along the ground of liberty and enlightenment, as he said, is to be gained by inches. It's a slow, patient progress, and you just can't achieve it overnight by snapping your fingers or by trying to force it on people militarily. And I think that's the great perversion and distortion of the thinking that's prevalent today.
Yeah, and you know, this is, you know, we can get enthusiastic, and everyone does. Everyone really gets excited about what we personally believe, and as a nation, we get excited about what we believe. And sometimes, in that excitement, that we think everyone needs it. It's the evangelist in all of us to spread the word. But at the same time, maybe the word isn't what's important as much as the example. And I think that's what Jefferson was really looking for: was, hey, create your own institutions, create these self-expressions, and people will look at that and recognize it as their own right and heritage as well, and would recognize those underlying values, not by force, but by pure observation about how effective they were and how far they went.
And don't we all know that in our own progress, in our own personal lives, that we need to learn for ourselves? We look to others for inspiration, but we we object when others try to force their ways on us. It's no different internationally.
You know, I have five children, and boy, does that illustrate the point. You know, on kids, because it's exactly that way. You know, some of the children listen and they follow that advice by learning from those examples. Others have to learn, as we all say, the hard way. And even nations go through this same thing. We're headed up to the break. Eric, are you going to be able to stick with me on the next hour, or are you tied up this morning?
No, I'll be able to stick with you.
All right, that's great. Okay, well, we're in the up for a break. It's going to be a short break, and then we're back, and then we'll be at the top of the hour, and then we'll go into the second hour. Second hour, we'll take some calls. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich and my guest, Eric Peterson, today, the author of the book, Light and Liberty. And I really recommend this book. It's not a heavy read. It's a very good read. It's $11.95. You can find it, I'm sure, on Amazon.com or any place where good books are sold. Eric has been talking to us about some of the background on our own country, and our own expression. I think it's important that we kind of reach back to those roots from time to time. And, you know, we're gonna continue this dialogue into the next hour as well. I want to also mention that the research provided that I do on the course of putting this show together is provided by the Lay Institute on Technologies, Inc., a Dallas-based nonprofit. And you can find information on the Lay Institute at layinstitute.org. So take a look there for more background on the Lay Institute. Eric, getting back to where we were on this topic today, what I'm excited about is the idea that finally some of these ideas are being brought back. I mean, this is, I think, a very important work. You know, some of the best things that I've read are sort of the resurrection of the ideas that really drove so much of what became not just this country, but what ends up being the institutions that we live with today. And, you know, institutions go through this cycle of revolution, evolution, and then devolution, I call it, when things start falling apart. Jefferson sort of shared that same idea. He expressed it a little bit differently. Maybe you'd care to comment some on that.
Yes, he felt that the tendency of all governments was to centralize power. And he said, you know, freedom degenerates when trusted to the rulers of the people alone. People are really responsible for participating in their self-government. He said that the tendency of power becomes centralized in whoever is ruling the country at any one time was so great that you needed a revolution every 20 years. Now, he wasn't talking about bloody revolutions, but he was talking about a revolution in thought and citizen participation and reexamining what we want to achieve as a society, how we work together to do that and achieve our common goals. And so he was a very, very active participant in establishing these principles and actually participating in government. Thomas Jefferson lived for some 83 years. He was born in 1743, and he lived all the way till the 4th of July, 1826. And in that time, he was in the service of the public some 61 years. So he had a chance to serve the public in 9 different public service offices. He was president, of course, we all know that, for 8 years, and starting in 1801. But he was vice president of our country under John Adams. He was wartime governor of Virginia during the last 2 years of the Revolutionary War. He was a Virginia state representative for many years before the war, and U.S. representative. He was a delegate to the Continental Congress, where he wrote the Declaration of Independence. And he held 2 diplomatic positions. A lot of people don't know that. He was our nation's minister to France for 5 years in the run-up period to the French Revolution in 1789. And he also was America's first Secretary of State, and 5 years after that under George Washington. And finally, of course, we all know that he was the founder, the father of the University of Virginia. He conceived of it. He hired the professors, planned the curriculum, acquired the library, and even designed the great campus. So he was a great server of the public, continually participating to the service of our country's highest ideals.
You know, we're headed up to the break again. We'll be back in just a few minutes with our guest, Eric Peterson, and the book is Light and Liberty. Highly recommended. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich and my guest, Eric Peterson, today on his book, Light and Liberty. We're talking about Jefferson. We're really talking about his own words. Eric has taken the time to put together a set of 34 of Jefferson's best ideas, I think, on a number of underlying values, the values that knit us together, whether liberal or conservative. These are the things that helped create this country, that allowed us to sort of express ourselves within the world community. And over 200 years now, we've been testing these ideas, and often, and I think more often than not, we've forgotten some of these basic principles, need to be reminded from time to time. Just before the break, we were talking about revolution happening every 20 years, just kind of the clock Jefferson put in motion. And I think maybe we can say, when we look back historically, there have been, you know, periods of every 20 to 30 years where big questions come up in the country that cause us to sort of rethink, reform. The last time this happened, it seems to me, was right during and right after the Watergate era of the early 1970s, where people really got focused on, I mean, if you think about the 60s and how turbulent they were leading into the 70s, and then what really happened was this call for reform in government. And now we are sitting 30 years later, and again, we're hit with that same call for reform when the government becomes more oppressive than supportive, and many feel that that's the trend that we've sort of followed again. And maybe that is the revolution of elections and public process, but it seems so much now, so much of this is dominated not by the old aristocrats of Europe, but really multinationals filling that role today. Maybe you'd want to comment on that concept. And how would Jefferson deal with multinationals as he leads today? Would he look at it the same way? Would he see it differently?
Well, I mentioned earlier that he was always concerned about what he called kings, priests, and nobles. And he said they represent various sectors of society, power centers of our society, who tend to ally themselves with other members of those three groups to sort of aid and abet their centralization and control and exercise of power, and the potential abuses that go with that. In his day, of course, kings meant literal kings.
Right.
Priests meant literal, you know, priests who with organized religion, which were very much, much more in control of society generally than the religious institutions are today. And by nobles, he meant, let's say, feudal landlords in Europe and Britain that controlled all the land and the wealth of society in those agrarian times. Today, he might say multinational corporations or other large corporate media, perhaps, large concentrations of power that tend to sort of aid and abet each other's abuses, as he called it. So he was for scattering power as widely as possible. And that's one of the reasons he was for a Bill of Rights. The United States Constitution, as you recall, did not have a Bill of Rights attached to it when it was originally passed, and Jefferson was aghast when he learned about that in Europe, because he thought that even majorities, we have majority rule here, and if you have power scattered as widely as you can, you still might have majorities that would impose rules that would violate fundamental rights of man, the rights that we all cherish, particularly the right of freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. That was first on Thomas Jefferson's list. And, of course, freedom of speech, press, assembly, freedom from arbitrary governmental arrest and imprisonment and searches and seizures and so forth, all the universal rights of man that are beyond any government. He wanted those rights preserved and enshrined so that no government, however it came to power, could be violative of those rights. That was critical to Jefferson, because he always saw these centralizing tendencies of large political, religious, or moneyed interests, and that their tendency to oppress the basic rights of man and engage in abuses.
Well, in that that idea that we would see this evolution of these kinds of institutions without being checked, I think is where we are today. We're headed into the break, and then we're into a long segment right after the break. And you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich and my special guest, Eric Peterson, talking about the ideas and writings of Jefferson, one of our founding fathers, one of the folks that many of us reference and go back to, and oftentimes really forget the essence of the ideas that really brought the country to where we are today. And I think this is this is probably, again, to get back to the real issues of who we are and our character, we have to go back really back to our founding fathers. And, you know, for this hour, I also want to allow callers to get in on this conversation with questions for our guests or perspectives. And I want to stay on topic today if we can, and let me give that call-in number if you want to call in today and get involved in the show. It's 800-313-9443. Again, call in at 800-313-9443. And I believe we've got one caller in Tennessee who's been hanging on for a long time. Are you still with me there?
Yeah, I'm still with you, and I'm all the way with you.
All right. You had a question for our guest.
No, but, you know, everything's going to hell. Every direction you look at is going to hell. And,
well,
and the only solution, I mean, the Bible says it's going to go to hell. And the only solution is Jesus Christ. He's
yeah,
the only way he can save us.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, and let me go back to Eric for a minute. Inside the book on Light and Liberty, there is a little section in there, and I thank you for the call. There's a little section in there that deals with Jesus, actually, and I was kind of surprised to see that. Maybe Eric could comment a little bit about on Jefferson's perspective on who that individual was and what he brought in the way of light.
Well, Jefferson was... a great student of philosophy, including religious philosophy. And he believes that, he said that the relations which exist between man and his maker and the duties resulting from those relations are the most interesting and important to every human being and the most important upon his study and investigation. In other words, going back to seeking truth within, if you will, from your own conscience, from your own study. Now, he studied the Bible. It was a very personal, private matter. And he felt that Jesus was a great moral teacher. And that he Jesus' own words are what Jefferson was particularly interested in, not so much the stories of the Bible, but the actual words of Jesus as reported in the Bible, and he thought that Jesus was a great moral teacher, and that if we all lived lives following Jesus' great moral precepts, we'd all live happier lives and be better servers of our fellow man. But that was all very, very private to Thomas Jefferson. We all recall Jefferson, of course, as the greatest champion in history for the principle of the separation of church and state.
Right.
When he ran for president, in the year 1800, he was bitterly attacked as a fanatic and an atheist, you know, for his support of the democratic aspirations of the French Revolution and for the principle of the separation of church and state, or he was an advocate, as we all remember, of a, as he famously put it, a wall of separation between the power of organized government and the power of religion. Organized religion, civil government should be separated, according to him. He thought it was, that should be done most fundamentally for the protection of religion, because Jefferson felt that freedom of religion was probably our most important freedom. He was against any one particular religion imposing its views on anybody else, particularly using the power of government to do that. At one point he wrote, "It does me no injury if my neighbor believes there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." And so he was very much, it's a very interesting dichotomy, because people really did think of him as an atheist because he thought it was for the protection of both religion and government to keep them separate in separate spheres. But as a private man, he was very much a man of faith. It's an interesting dichotomy that people don't necessarily appreciate about Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, and it really was, again, this idea of spreading power out, making sure it didn't concentrate as it had, where there was so much collusion between the kings and literal priests of Europe that had really subjected people not to being able to even self-express in even the simplest of ways, and that was again this idea of spreading it out. I've got another caller. I've got Daniel in Wisconsin. Are you still with me, Daniel? Daniel, are you there?
Yes.
You had a comment or question you wanted to add into the dialogue today.
Yes. All men are created equal. In the Constitution, blacks are counted as 3/5 person. Jefferson held slaves and even fathered children by a slave. In his writing, is there any recognition of the hypocrisy of his words versus the reality of slave ownership?
Great question, Daniel. I appreciate the call. Eric, do you have some comments on that or some thoughts about what
happened?
Sure.
That's a dilemma for so many people looking back at Thomas Jefferson's life and writings today. Thomas Jefferson wrote, nothing is more certainly written in the Book of Fate than that these people are bound to be free. So he saw their day of freedom eventually coming, and he hoped the sooner the better. And he also wrote, to the questioner's point, in the Declaration, a lot of people aren't aware of this, in the Declaration of American Independence, of which he was the author, he had two paragraphs in there on the subject of slavery. And in those two paragraphs, as part of the reasons for having a revolution against England, he wrote that he, meaning the King of England, has suffered men to be bound and changed and dragged thither to another continent to be bound in oppression and slavery against their will. And he referred to men, at capital M-E-N, the African Americans, the black Americans who were being brought to this country under the English slave traders, as he referred to them as capital M-E-N, in the same document that he referred, he authored this famous phrase, all men, lowercase M-E-N, are created equal. So clearly he was trying to make a point of equality of all men, regardless of race. Jefferson believed in the equality of the races and the actual, you know, divine spark that we all have that makes us all one people. And he knew that freedom would eventually come. I would say that there's a long answer to this question, but I think it's important to note as a practical matter that vision, Thomas Jefferson's vision, which has propelled our country's progress to this very day, takes time to manifest. And I think you can trace the progress that we've made as a society right back to Jefferson's principles in the Declaration and all the progress we've made on racial equality, gender equality, and all the societal progress we've made stems back directly to Thomas Jefferson's vision. And I think we should at least try to give him some credit for that.
Sure, and we can also, you know, make the observation that there aren't any women signing the Constitution either. I mean, the fact of the matter is women were disenfranchised politically at the time until much, much later. It wasn't just about race. It was really the cultural context in which these new ideas were coming forward, and they weren't going to change overnight. And I think the vision of the Founding Fathers was to look past the mentality of month-to-month, day-to-day living and say, where is this vision? Where are we going to be? And maybe they couldn't see where we'd end up in 200 years, but certainly the idea that they would create something that could preserve and evolve these fundamental ideas into practice within our civil society. And you know, I think that's what we forget is, you know, and again, when we go into other areas of the world and we look for that road to light, that road to understanding, it often doesn't happen as fast as we'd all like, but it's holding the vision that allows these things to manifest. I think Jefferson, and I think you would agree, was one of those guys that could project out and hold that vision even within the conflicts within his own life based on the culture he was within.
Yes, Thomas Jefferson, I'm sure, was conflicted about holding slaves, but I think a lot of people don't recognize that he did more than any of our founding fathers in terms of actions that he directly took, like the one I just mentioned in the Declaration. Right. To actually try to advance the cause of freedom of the slaves, he argued when he was 25 years old in the Virginia legislature to try to make it easier to emancipate slaves. At that time, you had to argue that they had rendered meritorious service in order to free them. He sponsored a bill that said you could free somebody, manumit them, it was the phrase, simply on your signature at the county courthouse. And he was hooted down and shouted down by the racist Virginia legislature when he tried to do that. He made many similar gestures. The first case he ever argued was for the freedom of a slave. When he wrote the precursor to the Northwest Ordinance, famous Northwest Ordinance, which admitted the new states in the Midwest after the Revolutionary War, he wrote the precursor law in the Federal Congress that said that after the year 1800, there shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude in the newly admitted states. That he was the author of that phrase and that bill. It was defeated by one vote, and he said in that awful moment, the fate of unborn millions was sealed.
Yeah.
So he was really actively working for the gradual rollback, emancipation, and liberation, even during his own time, of the slaves of his era.
Well, this is an important point, I think, that history, again, ignores in so many ways, you know, and maybe is the long answer is the better answer, because understanding the roots and the clarity and the conflicts and how these things evolve, nothing happens overnight. You know, good ideas are in the minds of people and projected into reality, and that does take time. You know, when we think about Jefferson, you know, one of the things that I saw recently on a trip to Australia is they put in a couple years ago while I was there, they had mandatory voting, which I thought, you know, this is horrible. You know, I'm listening to all these people talking about how wonderful it is. All the folks that were apathetic are now voting. And I said, look, you know, I said, now you've got people who aren't even interested in the ideas that are forced, coerced to vote, or they lose certain rights. And so you have people going with, you know, they're not going to get any deeper understanding. They're just going to show up at the polls and pull the lever according to the last soundbite they heard. You don't have liberty. Yeah.
Opinion poll.
Exactly. Let's go into the break. We're going to come right back. We still have a caller hanging in, too, and you can get involved in this show. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and we're talking with Eric Peterson on one of our great founding fathers, Jefferson. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're talking with Eric Peterson, our guest, on Light and Liberty, his book, and on the ideas of Thomas Jefferson. You know, Changing the Way We See the World is the name of the program. And a worldview is a view that really kind of broadens our perspective, makes us put things in context. And Jefferson was one of those that brought us a worldview, a very different worldview, and really was a radical. I mean, I don't think anyone could consider him anything different at his time, would be considered a radical, certainly a strong debater and someone who busted open this whole area of thinking. You know, and people forget that there were these huge battles that went on, you know, in terms of ideas. And we've talked a little bit about the Federalists and their position, this sort of overriding elitism that people really didn't want to see happen. Jefferson, coming from that ilk, actually took the very contrary position to many of his colleagues would have taken. And that couldn't have been an easy thing. And I think that Eric could comment a little bit about, you know, what happened in his life. I mean, he had, from most people's perspective, a very successful career, yet it wasn't always a smooth road. It was interfered with. It was a very, very tough life to live for 83 years in those days was ancient, I mean, in terms of age.
Yes, he was a great philosopher of freedom and oneness. He was also a great strategist, even a great tactician in the political battles. He and Madison formed their political party to oppose the Federalists, and they were attacked for their patriotism. I mean, it's not dissimilar to some of the things that are going on today. And Jefferson, there's a chapter in this book, Light and Liberty, on the subject of patriotism, and you get a clear feeling that Jefferson had an understanding of patriotism that's maybe a little bit different than we ordinarily hear about today. To Thomas Jefferson, patriotism was an unbounded love for your country, not an unrestrained love of your government.
Right.
Or its actions. And he had a clear difference between love of country and acceptance of the actions of the government of a country from time to time. By the country, obviously, he meant our lands, our natural beauty, the peoples of our country, our traditions, our rights. The beauty, the natural beauty of this great land, all the blessings that have been shed on the country of America, that's what he felt patriotism was all about. And he thought that it was pretty easy to confuse love of our country with love of our government. He thought government should be as limited and constrained as possible and just sort of allow the people the freedom to grow and serve. And that's a distinction that often gets lost. I put my finger on the actual Sedition Act that we mentioned earlier, in which people's patriotism was questioned legally. The Sedition Act said this: it is a crime to utter or publish false, scandalous, or malicious writings against the government. Of course, you're talking about the government, not the people. The government of the United States, with an intent to defame, to bring into disrepute, disrepute and contempt, to incite the hatred of the people, to stir up sedition within the United States. All that's really saying is if you express an opinion, if you love your country, and you express an opinion that's critical of what your rulers are doing at any particular time, you could have been jailed under this law. And, of course, you see similar sentiments in the air today. This
yes.
is not patriotism. This is dereliction of one citizen's duty to love their country and protest the actions of the government when they feel the government is going awry.
You know, this is a very, very important issue today. You know, we're seeing this idea that anytime you speak out, and it was really chilled after 9/11. I mean, nobody wanted to say anything against the government, except one guy from Vermont who voted against the Patriot Act that since hundreds of local governments, and Jefferson believed that was where the real power should lie anyway, hundreds of local governments across the country opposed that initial Patriot Act. And we haven't heard a lot of rumblings as much as I think we should on this revisit of the Patriot Act, but you know it's like the misnomer. You know, they give it a name that sounds all wonderful, but it really doesn't speak to the patriotism that Jefferson was.
It's the Government Act, not the Patriot Act.
Yeah, exactly. It transferred huge power to a government that already had huge power. I mean, when you look at the evolution of the country, a lot of power was stripped away during the Civil War and the revisiting of state sovereignty that was addressed through that. But all of these things, as we look, you know, to where we are today, and we start looking backwards, we have really seen the recreation on the context of modern technology of the same kind of oppressive aspects of government. And they don't require, as it did a few hundred years ago, a violent revolution, but they absolutely require a revolution of thinking. And that thinking, I think, goes back to Jefferson. Look inside yourself for that spark that makes us equal, and begin to express that into the world around us, and then change has the opportunity to really take root.
It's so interesting that you mentioned a congressman from Vermont in today's environment, because there was a congressman 200 years ago from Vermont named Matthew Lyon. And he was looking at the Federalist military buildup, increasing national debt, increasing taxes, having basically a sense of promoting a sense of fear and so forth. And, of course, ultimately passing the Sedition Act that we've been talking about. Here is what he said in criticism of the, this is Congressman Matthew Lyon from Vermont 200 years ago. This is what he said.
Hold it right after the break. This is an important point. I don't want to lose it in the music. We're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And when we get back, this is going to be a great thing because it puts us right back to where we are today by reflecting back over 200 years ago. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And I'm speaking with my special guest, Eric Peterson, a compiler and editor of Jefferson's work, Thomas Jefferson's work, bringing it together in a book form called Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. And an excellent, excellent read. I recommend it highly. Just before the break, we were talking about this lone representative from Vermont that had these ideas 200 years ago, the same kind of ideas being raised by others from Vermont in recent days. Go ahead and complete those comments and get back into that, because I think it's a very important point.
Well, thank you, Nick. And it was, yes, it was a similar time of a lot of fear in the air, fear of potential war or actual war, military buildups, the Sedition Act, as we've talked about, building up the national debt to extraordinarily high levels and so forth. And there was a fellow in Vermont, a congressman in 1798, who was a vigorous opponent of all that, and it was being led by the John Adams administration at the time with the support of Alexander Hamilton and the High Federalists in New England. And this is what Congressman Matthew Lyon from Vermont in 1798 had to say about his times, and there's some very interesting echoes in our times. As we might all observe, he said that he could not support the Adams administration when he saw that every consideration of the public welfare was swallowed up in a continual grasp for power, in an unbounded thirst for ridiculous pomp, foolish adulation, and selfish avarice, and that men of real merit were being turned daily out of office for no cause other than independency of sentiment, and that the sacred name of religion was employed as a state engine to make mankind hate and persecute each other.
Wow.
This is 1798 Congressman Matthew Lyon. And so
wow.
Interesting, you're talking about echoes from Jefferson's era in our world of today.
You know, that'll send chills right up your arms in a hurry. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. You know, it's almost, it's really about the nature of human beings. You know, we tend to repeat these same cycles and get lost in the same deceptions. And, you know, this is, you know, today fear is, in fact, we've talked about it a lot on my programs over the last few months, the idea that fear is absolutely the wrong place to be when trying to make the kind of decisions that shape the future and share a vision for that future. You know, you can't do it on a platform of fear. When you do, you end up transferring power in the thought that maybe it renders some level of safety and security. And that really, safety and security, from Jefferson's perspective, was more of an individual responsibility. And there were, on the national level, certainly the national military was, in fact, one of the very, very few things that the national government was supposed to be involved in. But the military was very separate from the civilian sector. They weren't like a standing army. They were called in and were mustered from the people in a very different way. And obviously, standing armies today are required. But the separation between military thinking, which is really fear-based thinking, they have to think of every horrible situation that can ever occur and build a plan around it. But that kind of fear-based thinking, when it migrates its way into the general public through our political processes and through our government, we really lose sight of the idea that it's through the clear thinking of the average individual that good public policy evolves.
Yes, I think that Jefferson would have put fear and appeals for fear right at the top of the list of ignorance. As we talked about before, he said light and liberty go together. And by light, as we mentioned, he meant freedom from ignorance.
Right.
And ignorance, if you look at the list of things that are ignorant, succumbing to fear and getting all wrapped up in appeals to fear is probably number one on the ignorance list. Jefferson said that, this is his quote, in order to procure tranquility, we must avoid fear and desire, which he called the two principal diseases of the human mind. And in his later years of correspondence, when he was corresponding with his friend John Adams, they had reconciled toward the end of their lives. He wrote John Adams a letter, and he said, how much pain have cost us the evils which have never happened? We might say today, don't worry, be happy.
Yeah.
So he's basically saying it's a tendency to get caught up in fear. Most of the fears don't materialize, but while you're experiencing the fear, you're causing yourself pain.
Right.
He said the giver of life gave it for happiness and not for wretchedness or that kind of pain that we're inflicting upon ourselves as a nation today by this continual orgy of fear that we're all whipped up in.
Right, right. You know, I've got a caller. Dylan in Texas has been waiting quite a while. I'm going to take Dylan, and then after Dylan, I'm going to take Maryland and California. Dylan, are you still with me?
I sure am, gentlemen.
All right. You had a comment or question for our guest.
Yeah, and what's your name, sir, the guest?
It's Eric Peterson is our guest today.
Eric Peterson, and what's the name of the book you've compiled of Jefferson's writings?
It's called Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. And it's 34 of Jefferson's ideas really broken down in the book. It's a very good book.
I see. Yeah, I want to comment on the letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to Benjamin Rush, January 1st of 1802. And in it is a... just a few words that are taken out of context, and the sentence in it, in which that is used for ill purposes, is the First Amendment has erected a wall of separation between church and state to ensure that the government would never interfere with religious affairs. And of course, at the time of this writing, the church congregations were viewed rightly as private affairs. And, of course, the government was public, and it's just an obfuscation, a misconstrued, just a deletion of words in context. And I just want to comment on one thing you said, Doctor. You said mentioned the disenfranchisement of women.
Yeah.
Actually, that didn't actually occur because the universal suffrage had not taken effect, actually, or in theory, even here in the colonies, nor
right.
had it in Europe.
Right, and what I'm saying is the state of affairs then was different. So, you know, things were looked at differently, and you're absolutely right. It hadn't taken place yet. It wasn't even considered. I mean, it wasn't even in the consciousness of our founding fathers yet. The very institutions that were created then eventually led to that possibility that did happen in this country and around the world. I appreciate the call, Dylan. Did you want to comment on some of that?
Yes, just a comment on the issue of church and state. My view is that Thomas Jefferson felt that the effort to just separate out our civil government from organized religion, just let them live peacefully in their separate spheres, was the hardest battle of Thomas Jefferson's life. He wrote the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom in 1777, and it wasn't passed by the Virginia legislature until 1786, and it became the model of the federal constitution, principle of religious freedom. And he said that was the hardest bill that he ever wrote or fought, because it basically established the principle of freedom of conscience. He said, Almighty God hath created the mind free and manifested his supreme will that free it shall remain by making it altogether insusceptible of restraint. In other words, that the natural order of things was that men have freedom of thought, and so he wanted to establish the principle of freedom of conscience for any particular belief, religion, or non-belief. He abolished religious tests for holding office. He abolished the taxation of the general public to support one particular state religion. So this is really vital to Thomas Jefferson's whole existence. And in fact, he included the authorship of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom as among the three greatest achievements of his life, along with the Declaration of Independence authorship and the founding of the University of Virginia.
You know, and that debate from the time he introduced it in 1777 until it was passed was a 9-year long debate. That's a long debate to continue to engage to its completion. I think that's an impressive statement too about his tenacity to not just say these things and write these things, but put his life action in making the change. And something that I've said to listeners is, you know, the real power, the real faith in all of this is stepping into what we know to be right and true and doing something, not just talking about it. And it's something that Jefferson exemplified in his whole living experience over 60 years of public service out of the 83 that he lived, focused on the idea that you could give out of yourself great things and stimulate others to do the same. And in all of that, good things were possible. And I think those are the reminders we need today, is these examples of people stepping forward and recognizing the essence of who we are. You know, those with a Christian background know that we're created in the image of the Creator. That's a powerful, very powerful thing. When you think about that in the context of each and every person, when you look in the eyes of another, if you believe this, then you're looking in the eyes of God himself, because all of us are that outspring, that small little microcosm of all of that potential. And I think Jefferson saw the potential of people as being even more than we individually see. We're our own worst critics, yet governments, when they get formed, they become hyper-powerful in the sense that they take on their own personalities, which is supposed to be a reflection of all of ours, and often doesn't work out that way, which is why this sort of recycling of revolution was always part of his thinking, to make us re-examine our government and the ideas being put forward. And what I would say today is to look back, is look at what is generating our actions. If it's fear-based, a push by using fear as the motivator, this is not what this country was about. It was about the confidence in knowing who we were, where we might go, and the idea that we could do this together as average people and really build something that was much, much different as an institution.
Jefferson said, "We too shall encounter follies. But if great, they will be short. If long, they will be light. And the vigor of our people will get the better of them."
You know, and that's something else that, you know, Americans, we tend to be the 2 minutes till midnight crowd. You know, we wait till it's really bad. And if it's sliced off a little bit at a time in terms of being light, being slow, sometimes we don't see it until that 2 minutes till midnight. And that's when the change takes place. And I think the country's at a 2 minute to midnight point. We're at a point where we need to reexamine what we're doing around the world and how that's being reflected in public policy. And once we've done that, once we've accomplished that, then perhaps real change might take place. And we might see the kind of revitalization of those basic values lost, in my opinion, so many years ago.
I think that's true. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, he said that I abhor war and view it as the greatest scourge of mankind. If nations were to go to war for every degree of injury, there would never be peace on earth. And he went so far as to say that the lamentable recourse of war should be reserved for actual injuries only, and not for what he called the evils of the imagination.
So this idea of preemptive warfare certainly wouldn't fit this theme now, would it?
Well, it wouldn't. It certainly wouldn't fit us in domestic society here with our own criminal laws. You can't attack your neighbor because you think he might begin to attack you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a crime in the United States. How can it be not a crime when we do it internationally?
Yeah, exactly right. And these are things that we often forget. You know, in the context of new technologies that are capable of wiping out entire countries, the idea of preemptive warfare is certainly one that needs to be challenged. You know, we've heard a lot of rhetoric in recent days about the Constitution from both parties. But this idea that the Supreme Court has ruled on some of the things that we've done overseas, we've taken interrogations, things that would be classified as even torture out of the boundaries of the United States. And the rationale that we've heard is, well, it's not in the country, therefore maybe the Constitution doesn't apply. And this is something that really runs counter again to the principles of Jefferson, the idea that our values really do travel with us, but they shouldn't travel very far from our shores very often and without a darn good reason.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Thomas Jefferson really felt that the people do have the right to self-determination in other countries. They do have the right to respectful treatment. And so when you engage in conquest and in torture and things like this, these are elements of just a general category of ignorance that he would call those things ignorant. And he said, this is a very profound observation, I think. This is his quote. If a nation expects to be both ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. So we have to work on the light part of light and liberty, I think, in our country.
Yeah, and this is, you know, and this requires a level of tolerance, and tolerance not being believing or accepting what someone else says. It's just making sure that they have the right to say it. You know, and I come from a big family, and it's a political family here in my part of the world, and we are very different. We've got liberals and conservatives and everything in between the six of us siblings. And yet, when we get together, we have these incredible debates, but they're founded on these basic principles. So when we leave the room, we are arm in arm together as family members, and I think it's a reflection of what we need to remember within our own countries. We can have all of these differences, but it's those underlying values that unite us ultimately and provide the platform so we can have that debate, and we can't allow it to become vicious and negative. We need it to be constructive, not destructive, to support our right to say and be, and at the same time encourage others to have that same right, something I think Jefferson understood and we've often forgotten today.
That's wonderfully said. I mean, Jefferson believed that light, along with liberty on a societal basis, means, as you just said, a spirit of reason, what he called candor, moderation, tolerance, as you mentioned, and he said mild laws, readily obeyed, and he said valuing self-government above all other blessings. That was his definition of light on a societal basis. It sounds like you've achieved that within your own family. He would say, and as you said, that this is really what we should be trying to achieve amongst ourselves as a national society. He said, you know, he basically said every society is formed as a moral person, and every member of it is personally responsible for his society conducting themselves in the enlightened fashion that you just described.
You know, and this is, I think, again, a reflection of how we look at our families as our nucleus, and something that I think when people looked at structuring government and looking at, you know, how conflicts are resolved and even projecting it out into our international affairs today, it's that attitude of accepting the fact. And I think this is where when we go into countries and we find that perhaps there's no corresponding values, there's no corresponding belief structure, maybe that's the point in which we say, hey, it's time for us to leave, because we're then just imposing ourselves on the free will of others, something that even God in most traditions doesn't do, impose himself on the free will of others, and yet we do that. Now, when attacked, I think Jefferson was pretty clear, when attacked, you respond, and you respond vigorously. But unless you're attacked, maybe there is a time to reflect and allow people to be left alone. We've got one more segment after the break. This is Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich and my very special guest, Eric Peterson, the author of Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time, and our very special guest, Eric Peterson, the author of the book Light and Liberty, is with us today. This show will be archived on the RBN Live website, so I encourage people to let folks know and pass the word on and have folks review this. I think it reminds us of some of those fundamental values. Eric, going into this last segment, you know, we have just a few more minutes. What things have we missed that really need to be said before we're out of time today?
Well, maybe we could just take a few more moments on the subject of centralized government power and the duties of citizens in the electoral process and participating in preserving their own liberties.
Sounds good to me. Let's go there.
Thomas Jefferson was a candidate for many offices throughout his life. He held many elective as well as appointive offices. And he boiled down the questions that he thought an enlightened citizenry should ask about any candidate for public office. And they're very simple, but I think they're very right on target. And since this is election season coming up, perhaps it might be a good time to
absolutely
state what Thomas Jefferson thought citizens should be asking about candidates for public office. So here they are. Is he honest? Is he or she capable? Is he faithful to the Constitution? And is he a friend of peace and of economy in the public expense? Those are the questions that Thomas Jefferson thought good people should ask about candidates for office. Obviously, he felt the opportunity to vote when half of our citizens don't even take the trouble to vote. He would question whether or not we have enough light to sustain our liberties, and do we value self-government above all other blessings. And I think he'd want citizens to be very careful about the centralizing, the basic nature of government to centralize its power, and it's really beyond any particular party. I think we can look at two examples today and really say that it's time for citizen action. One, of course, is the increase in public debt. Jefferson himself paid down the federal debt by one-third during his time of office.
Wow.
And he said that we shall all consider ourselves unauthorized to saddle posterity with our debts and morally obligated. It wasn't a matter of economic principle with him. It's a matter of morals. Morally obligated to pay them ourselves within what may be deemed to be the period of a lifetime.
Wow.
So he was against what we would call today intergenerational tyranny. He said he was against all forms of tyranny over the mind of man. Certainly intergenerational tyranny was one of those. And finally, he would look at something like gerrymandering, I think, today. A lot of people aren't necessarily aware of it. In a certain sense, it's an abstract or arcane issue, but it's really vital to the opportunity for citizens to govern themselves. When both parties in our country have arranged electoral districts in a way that favors one incumbents, whether of either party, it almost guarantees that unless there's a tremendously strong swing in public opinion, there really is no change in the political makeup of the United States, the House of Representatives. So that's an example of centralized power that he thought we should try to transcend.
Eric, thank you for being with me. Let us all rise out of the apathy, out of the ashes of our apathy, and change the way we see the world. Let's get involved this year. It's election year. Thanks for being with me. You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. This has been Dr. Nick Begich with Changing the Way We See the World, and my very special guest, Eric Peterson, author of Light and Liberty. Get that book. It's a great one. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you all next week.